squad.
Oh, what's going on, squad?
Hey, didn't see you there, squad. Also didn't hear you there because, and I'm going to whisper this part, squad, because as you can probably hear, yeah. So my neighbor, the door slammer, got a puppy, and the puppy is going through her, you know, puppy period where she cries a lot. So you can probably hear her screaming as if she's being murdered because they left for the 8 trillionth time in the past week. So I'm apologizing right now. It's Brittany's episode, thankfully, so you probably won't hear me speaking that much, and I'm going to try to edit it out as much as I can. But as you can hear, she is beside herself.
Can I say, and I'm probably setting us off on the wrong foot by saying this, this should be a tight episode. I only have 8 pages of notes. This is a pretty, like, straightforward
it case. Is. It's. I was wondering, it was so funny that you said that this was an easy episode for notes, because I was watching it yesterday, and, like, and again, it's not boring. It's actually a riveting episode. But because, I don't know, it's like it was so riveting that, like, the details kind of were a blur. Like, when they were like, here's how we found the cabin, I'm like, I don't even know what they just said.
Where there aren't
is
really details.
Man?
I'm gonna say it's like pretty, like,
I'm a little obsessed with us recapping this and realizing that a lot of the dialogue is actually not
it's just trash.
Super detailed. This was weird for me because I remembered almost scene by scene, not scene by scene, I shouldn't be so dramatic, but I remembered, like, almost every scene. I was like, yes, I remember this, but I could not tell you the ending or any, like, if I was, like, sitting there with you and I was like, I totally remember this, and you're like, really, what happens next? I'd be like, shh, I don't know.
Oh, the ending was a total shock to me. I was like, oh, okay, great.
It was pretty much just like, that's it.
I did like that we didn't spend too many, I don't know, I guess I get mad at the episodes where they spend, like, half the episode based on an assumption they made, and then halfway through they're like, oh my god, this? And I'm like, well, you hadn't made an assumption like 20 minutes ago.
Like last episode where they were just whiplashing between assumptions. They were like, this, no that, no this.
Now, speaking of last episode, can I read you the write-up from Law & Order SVU, the unofficial companion?
Yes.
I thought you'd love it. So this is for last episode, Folly, reviewing the case. Pretty boys are dropping like flies as they unzip their pants to pleasure older women because someone has declared open season on male escorts from the Man About Town Companionship Service. Various well-connected New Yorkers come under scrutiny, but a strange obsession turns out to be the inciting factor in this case full of complex people and a tangle of carnal desires. Adroit viewers may easily guess what the final twist will be, but half the fun is in the process of getting there.
Oh my god, he was like losing it.
At some point, I would like us to discuss which murderers we would least like to be murdered by, and this is probably like my top guy.
This is my top guy. Yeah, I'll take... I'm trying to think of what other murderers were even this bad. I mean...
Like the child... Like,
the
like
child killer was even slightly more humane. He would strangle them and then...
I know.
Wade them gently into the bay.
Like, he's not even like as bad of a person as this guy.
Well, squad, a quick little intro thing. I'm going to start doing this, although we're 20, 30 minutes too late to the intro. If you're new here, we are Elite Squad Pod, SVU in review. I think it's a little self-explanatory, but just to kind of tell you what we do here, we, Brittany and Paige, I am Paige, and that is Brittany over there.
Hi.
We recap Law & Order SVU from season one until Elliot Stabler leaves the show.
And not an episode more.
And not an episode more. We discussed it. We actually tried. We tried. If you want to go back to, I think it was episode, it was like episode 5. It's the one about, we have like first kid and it's our cover photo.
That is 5 because that's the fucked up Wanderlust episode.
Yes. So that one we tried to do a new episode because it was supposed to be when Elliot and fucking Olivia kiss, and then they bait and switched us again, and we have just not, you know what, and that's what we said, we're like, we're not doing this shit, we're not doing this shit. Oh my god, you came here for a positive experience, I'm screaming at you, I'm so sorry, new people.
I'm so sorry, we'll
so
stop.
Sorry,
we'll
we do
stop.
Do that a lot though, I apologize.
We do yell a lot.
We yell so much. So we are recappers, so we are recapping episodes from beginning to end, and we are also doing, I guess you could call them analyses.
Slight commentary.
Commentary. Thank you, Brittany. Obviously, we're hilarious, and so we make jokes in between. So we're recapping, but we're not taking it terribly seriously. We will be making jokes at the expense of this show, but we love it, so it's all out of love.
We're both wearing Elliot and Olivia sweatshirts right now, and we didn't coordinate this.
Another order of business. I want to say thank you so much for the kind words that we've been receiving recently. Caveat, the two I'm speaking about are not actually terribly recent. One of them came from a DM from April, and I just saw it.
I saw that too. I was like, oh my God, that's so nice.
It was so nice. And I'm not going to call you out, but you know, you responded to one. I announced when our next episode would be, and you responded to it saying, finally, in all caps. And I was like, who is this kind person? And then I realized that you had messaged us in April, and neither of us saw it because we're old and just a little, well, we're beautiful, but just a little ditzy.
I also hate social media. So yeah. Just know when we post. It's because we love you, but we hate social media.
We're kind of bad. Like, I will open my own messages a lot and forget. Not forget to. I just don't know that I'm doing it because a lot of times I cross-click. Like, I'll be going to click something else on my phone, and then I'll get a message, and then it pops up, and I freak out, and I force quit all my apps. So I think that's what happened here. Another thank you is we got, again, I'm not going to call out your handle because, I don't know, this is why I put people on blast. But if you're listening, we got a really great review on Apple Podcasts. Oh my God, I sound so old. I don't even know if that's what it's called. Apple Podcasts. I think it was in May you left this really, really, really nice review about us being your, like, she's like, I think it said, have I found my squad? ? That was such a nice review. Thank you so much. You all sound kind of like us, so.
You sound fun. I hope you're still listening and you weren't like, wow, they never acknowledged my really nice review.
Because you know what? I would think that.
Fuck these girls. Talk about having 5 listeners. They actually have 7.
Oh, one more little announcement, just a repeat. I said at the end of last week's episode. Actually, this is actually on topic. We're going to be doing every other week episode releases from now on. I guess we'll just say for the foreseeable future. Weekly, just like, I don't know, I feel bad when we can't do it because then it just feels like a weird bait and switch. We're like, we're going to do it weekly. Oops, never mind. Oops.
We're tired. It takes 4 hours to write notes for this episode.
Exactly. Yeah, it takes a lot. And like, and this is not us being like, oh, it takes a lot. Like, boo-hoo. Like, it's what we picked. But also, we want to deliver you the best content. Anyway, I'll shut up now. Ugh, thank God. Thank you. I've been praying.
Just in time. All right, everyone, are your seats buckled? Because this episode, actually, as I was going to say, sucks, but I'm like, it's really good, but it's really dark. All right, this episode, we are talking about Law and Order Special Victims Unit, Season 2, Episode 18, Manhunt. Original air date, April 20th, 2001, and directed by the returning Stephen Wartimer of Closure. Part 1.
Nice.
I was like, I couldn't remember what Closure was for a minute. And then I'm like, oh, Harper Anderson, who actually comes up in my notes very briefly.
Oh my God. That means alignment.
So we open on the streets of New York City. It is nighttime. And two young for SVU people are leaving the diner. It's a man and a woman. And this guy is trying to goad a woman named Annie to go have a drink with him. He's not a great actor, but he's kind of endearing. I like him.
Me too. Okay. He's like a little cute, but like in a grungy way. Like
Shaggy Rogers from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Like I definitely found myself, I had to rewind because I found myself sort of like going off on a little New York adventure with him in my head. I was like, he's the type of guy that you like walk around the city with all night and like trade stories about your vinyl records.
Things would have gone a lot different for a character if she'd gone with that option.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So Annie tells him she can't because she smells like French fries. And he's like, oh, that's okay. I love French fries. And she's like, oh, I just can't. She just wants to go home and relax. Maybe next time she's like, does she say have a bath?
Yeah.
I kept thinking she was going to have a bath. And she's like, and watch my people.
She says she was going to have a bubble bath and read her People magazine.
I thought she said like read her people. And I was like, is that like a readable soap opera?
Yeah, read her people.
Now I'm like, oh my God, People magazine.
My God,
that's
you're so like, I almost said industrialized. I meant like so tech now. You didn't forget about People magazine.
People magazine. I only read People when I go to the hairdresser, which is like once a year. So Annie walks off and this guy turns and lights a cigarette and mumbles to himself, oh, I love French fries. So stupid. So he was like clearly into her.
Yeah.
Suddenly, as he's walking away, he starts hearing sounds of distress and he turns to find this scary ass dude literally pushing Annie into a vehicle. So he runs over and tries to intervene, and the assailant pulls a gun on him. And he starts to back off, and I was kind of judging him for a moment. But as soon as the guy's back is turned, he does try to leap on the guy again. And impressively on the guy's part, he literally turns, gives him a one hit, and this poor guy goes flying. So yeah, like, this assailant is like strong as fuck. Yeah, he's like a big, scary looking bearded dude.
This is literally my nightmare, by the way. Like, if anyone wants to know what my dead ass my nightmare is, oh my God, no.
I found this scene really scary because we've almost been led to believe that usually the two people you see at the beginning of an SVU episode are about to stumble upon the crime.
Yes.
It was almost like, because usually it's almost like we're put in the place of those people, yeah, like stumbling upon a scary scene. And instead it feels like one of us has been taken. Yes. I found it very scary.
That's a really good analysis. Okay, I'll stop interrupting you. Oh, thank you. Sorry, that sounded really, I meant it. It sounded kind of like, that's a really good analysis.
Well, it just came to me.
It was great.
I was like, sounds like I'm stoned. You know, it's almost like we were taken.
My response kind of sounded stoned. I was like, that was such a good analysis.
So another guy comes running from around the car and also tries to intervene, but is also pushed away. The kidnapper peels off as the two guys try to chase the car down, and they both kind of fall in almost a funny way where they're like,
it was embarrassing.
I know. And also very, I don't know, there's almost something sadder to me about someone watching this happen to you and they can't help you. So the police are on the scene, and we find out it is a Munch and Finn episode. They arrive, and the uniform on the scene explains that the victim was Annie Tassler, a waitress at the diner. And then Finn asks why they're here for kidnapping. Instead of answering, the officer shows them a rag soaked in chloroform that was found on the scene and explains that the kidnapper took off in a green 4x4. And at first I thought this was bad writing. It was one of those things like, why are we here? Look at this chloroform. And there was a green 4x4. I was like, so?
When they said 4x4, I guess I didn't know that was a car. So I was like, do you mean a piece of wood?
So the officer tells them about the witnesses, Butch McGee, which is an awesome name.
Come on now.
And he looks like a Butch McGee.
He kind of does.
They're like, he's a slinger at the diner. I'm like, so he's a cook? The other guy is Martin Potter. He's the Good Samaritan who jumped in to help. So Finn asks Munch what he's missing, and Munch explains that last summer, a guy abducted four women using the same MO, raped and tortured them, and left their bodies stacked in a warehouse in Alphabet City. And they went on to call this guy the Bowery Stalker. So Munch and Finn find Butch and Martin sitting in the back of an ambulance, nursing their wounds a little bit dramatically. I'm like, okay, this poor girl, God knows what's about to happen to her. But the like two of them are just like, oof, ouch.
My skinned knee.
Like one of them like, I think it's Martin.
It's
has
Martin.
Like the skinned knee and is wrapped up like an orphan. He didn't even fucking know the victim. Poor Butch.
He's got a dumb fucking look on his face, too. Sitting yes. there like a glass doll wrapped in a blankie.
Ugh. And like, Butch is being wicked helpful. He describes the kidnapper as a big guy. Okay, I'm saying wicked helpful. He's the one who's more verbal and he like has more details. He describes the kidnapper as a big guy with a beard and a baseball cap. And he thinks he's been in the diner a few times, but he never got a good look at his face. Funch asked Martin what his, they go, what's your deal?
I know that was okay.
And he's like, I tried to help. So then
kinda,
like,
he like barely. Ran, like we didn't really get into it, but like it was so, again, embarrassing. He like ran over as Butch is struggling a second time with the assailant and he goes, get off him. And he kind of like flings himself on top of both of them. And then the assailant just shoves him off. And then they both chase the car and he goes, come back. And then he falls.
And then he falls. Oh, yeah. Martin is useless. So they ask Martin if he has anything to add. And Butch chimes in again to say he saw a tattoo, like a cat or something, on his right forearm. And he's willing to work with a sketch artist. So the EMT is like, can I take them? And I'm like, really? For what?
Yeah, the EMT goes, we've really got to get them out of here. I'm like, for what? They're boo-boos? They're woo-boo-boos.
Like, nothing's broken. They don't need stitches. They are fine.
No, like, genuinely confused why they need to be rushed away.
I'm so glad you thought the same thing, because I was really like, what?
Oh, I was writing through my first watch, I was a little tipsy from happy hour. And so I wrote, like, I literally wrote, LOL, so embarrassing, when they fell.
Thank you. So Funch walk a distance away, and Finn asks Munch how long he thinks he'll keep her alive. And Munch says, Tilly's finished with her.
I know, that was so unhelpful.
Troubling.
Yeah.
Deeply troubling.
I don't know. Like, I know what he meant, but it's also like, I don't want to hear that at work.
Like, no, like, deadass, like, do you have, like, a couple days in mind? Like, she's going to be dead in 24 hours, 48 hours.
Like, I'm trying to start working now on this. Like, I'm not trying to do cutesy little, like, Stabler Olivia banter here.
I think the autopsies probably told you how long each girl was kept alive, so I bet you could make a rough estimate.
Yeah. It's like, sometimes we just need to be working and we need to not be, like, quipping, you know?
So we're in Cragen's office, and Stabler is giving Cabot a Cabot rundown. And he explains that the Bowery Stalker goes after petite women. Wouldn't you be, like, a little flattered?
I was thinking that. As someone who is
annoyed, a millennial with a toxic relationship to her body, like any good millennial.
Right? Like, I'm kind of like, well, you know, it's nice that I'm kidnappable, but also a little not nice. It's like, I'm flattered, but it's not nice that I'm now too light to be considered a burden.
He explains the Bowery Stalker goes after petite women, subdues them with chloroform, and then carries them away in a dark 4x4. This is his first attack in a year, and then Munch enters the room looking bummed out as fuck, even though he always looks bummed out, but this time he comes in with, like, a puss on his face. He's like,
yeah.
It's
like he's mad it can't just be a cold case.
They're always mad when they have to do their jobs.
Now I'm kind of getting a little insight into how cold cases happen. They're kind of, it's them being like, ugh, it's just, oh, by the way, I'm pretty sure we're in April now.
We are.
We're in April.
So Cragen remarks that Munch is late, and Munch says he was up all night interviewing witnesses. So I'm kind of like, are you late or not? Like, shouldn't Cragen know you've been working?
I don't even know who's in the wrong here, because it's like, shouldn't you assume they're always kind of doing something if they're late?
Yeah.
They're adults. Like, do they even You're have, late. Yeah, like, do their shifts even work like that in a situation like this?
He doesn't have a cell phone. He can't, like, text him, like, hey, meet Cabot at 10 a.m.
Right, like, and we have heard that they're the best detectives, so it's, like, assume that they're fucking doing something. I thought it was inappropriate. Inappropriate. In a group setting, too.
So, I'm going to generalize this because I feel like there was a lot of, like, a quippy Munch back and forth. There are some hurt feelings because the DA is giving this case a lot of attention, which you would think is a good thing, but Munch is taking it as bad, and it's like because he didn't get the guy last time. But I'm like, this guy sounds really bad. I'm pretty sure the DA is like, holy shit, this guy's back. Get him.
I mean, I get where he would maybe feel like guilty, like, fuck, we didn't find him to begin with. But, like, it's not for lack of efforts. I mean, we've seen what they've been dealing with.
Yeah. And then Munch starts whining that they started the team meeting without him. And I'm like, well, it's called a Cragen rundown, not a Munch rundown. So chill out.
And maybe that was why now we're hearing that Cragen said you're late, because he didn't want to hear it from Munch. He's like, before you even fucking start with me about starting this meeting without you. It's like that friend who expects you to wait, but, like, they're always late. Like, it's fine if you're late and you're like, oh, go without me, I'm so sorry, like, I'll catch up with you. But it's like that person who's like, you're not going to, like, wait for me. It's like, no, you're the late one. Dick.
You dick.
Richard.
And then, I didn't think they could do this, but Benson and Stabler try to leave because it's awkward. They're like, I'm like, are you guys done? Like, why are you trying to leave? And Cragen's like, you need to stay.
Because they have a fucking vacation plan together. And
they do.
And this is encroaching.
Cragen tells them to stay and that they have to canvass the area. And then Munch is like, no, this is my case. And Cragen's like, yes, you are the primary on this case, but you need backup. And then he tells Munch to fill Cabot in while Finn is working with the witness and a sketch artist. And this is actually just so messy. And I think it speaks to the fact, sometimes I don't think Munch treats Cragen as a superior. I think he thinks they're kind of like equals.
Well, now I know why. I didn't realize, but this scene made it painfully obvious to me how much taller Munch is than Cragen.
Dun dun. So Munch and Cabot walk through the precinct together as he tells her about the case. I was about to say, I thought we fucking knew everything about this case, but there's, like, one kind of crucial detail that we haven't heard yet. About a year ago, a woman named Sarah Kimmel stumbled into a bar on Avenue D. She was half naked and beaten and claimed that a man with a beard had imprisoned her as a sex slave in an abandoned warehouse. The police raided it and found a cell that had sex toys and instruments of torture, as well as 4 mutilated bodies. There were a few partials for DNA, but nothing that could be matched. They staked out the building for a month and nothing. And then as Munch makes himself a cup of tea, Finn comes hustling over. The witness has filled in some details on the tattoo, and they ran it through a database of tattoos.
A tattoo base.
Which sounds true for now, but I didn't think they would have had one back then.
It sounds like a Clueless, you know, like wardrobe closet organizer thing. Like, it's probably, some people are probably hitting their steering wheels. It's probably like people who are in the system with logged tattoos. But it just, the way they say it, they're like, gonna run it through our system. And I'm like, what, the tattoo system?
The tattoo. And now I'm like, wait, no, I've answered my own question.
I love it, when I do that.
I'm like, wait, this is so dumb. So this guy, Frank Taggart, who was on parole for assault, I'm sure his tattoo was in the system and they ran it against the, what's it called? Usually, like, is it like discernible markings? Like, usually,
yes,
when, like, they kind of have a database of like weird scar.
Yeah,
like pierced nose, that kind
of
shit.
When they haul people in for beating the fucking tar out of their girlfriends, they're like, weird fucking sketchy ass tattoo on left arm.
So Finn holds up a picture of a bearded man, and because we don't really get a great look at the guy in the first scene, it like totally could be him.
Oh, they're like doppelgangers. And it actually
totally looks like the actual guy.
It does.
This isn't the guy. It's not the guy. He works as a custodian at a fish market. So Dun Dun, Funch head to a fish market and have the dumbest conversation where we learn that Munch, like Finn is like, who the fuck would work here? And Munch was like, me when I was young. And
I Finn's would actually like, dude, work really? There too. I love fish. I mean, it's morbid because they're dead bodies, but I just think fish are so beautiful. I'm like one of those fucking dumbasses who stare at the fish in Whole Foods, and I'm like, that red snapper is real beautiful.
So Munch is immediately greeted by a large, exuberant man who calls him Munch Man, and they hug, which is cute. This guy's nickname is Olive, and they have like this history together, but don't worry, we learn basically nothing. So they ask about Taggart, and Olive points out the door. Funch pull Taggart aside, and Taggart immediately tries to wrestle Finn into like the ice filled with fish. I was like, but why?
Where has this ever worked? Where have the cops have been like, you know what? We're gonna stop trying to do our job now instead of arresting you more.
Which is exactly what happens. Like, Munch immediately puts his like gun to the guy's temple and is like, you're so under arrest. And the guy's like, oh my god. So Dun Dun, obviously, we're in the mean interrogation room.
Yeah, this guy's mean.
He's mean. And they take a good look at his tattoo. And he tells them he got it at Elmo's Tats. They ask him where he was last night, and he, like, tells them he was at a bar. They accuse him of grabbing Annie, and he's like, nah. And they have a back and forth, and he's just like, it's not me.
Yeah.
Dun dun. So in the bullpen, Funch tell Cragen that the bartender said that Taggart left around 11, so he actually could technically have time to drive to the diner to kidnap Annie, but he does not have a 4x4 registered to him. So Cragen tells them that they need to do a lineup and they need to bring in the aforementioned Sarah Kimmel. And Munch does give him pushback because, like, Sarah Kimmel was deeply traumatized by what she's been through. And Cragen's like, listen, if Butch and Martin can identify him, she probably won't have to, but, like, you do need to bring her in for, like, backup. Dun dun. Butch is up first for the lineup and he's like, do any of them have tattoos? Which, I have seen a lineup where they just did tattoos.
I was like, going to say.
No faces, just tattoos.
I think they did that on this show at some point. Because it was like Scorpion.
I mean, he's been up front the whole time that he didn't see the face. He just saw that tattoo. So I'm kind of like, yes, they could do this, but not in this episode, I guess.
Not now.
So Cabot, like, tells him he needs to identify the guy's face. And he's like, I also appreciate when he just says he can't. Instead of, like, bullshitting and, like, looking at them and being like, oh, I guess that guy. He's like, no.
Yeah, yeah.
Martin is up next, and he fucking hems and haws between. He's like, 4. No, 5. 5. It's definitely 5. And they're like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, it's 5.
He's such a dum-dum. So 4 is Frank Taggart, and then 5 is, like, not. Well, they say it, you know, but it's just funny because, like, you know, you're like, okay. And then he goes, nope, definitely 5. And you're like, ugh.
So after he leaves, Cragen dryly comments that Officer Peters will be pleased that he was identified as the Bowery Stalker. Dun dun, on to Sarah Kimmel. So Munch finds Sarah in the nice interrogation room, and she's like, yeah, I can't do this. And Munch assures her that the suspect won't be able to see her. Sarah has been Harper Andersoned before Harper went like full-blown vigilante and wicked awesome. She has to sleep with the lights on. She's on disability because she can't hold down a job and just basically living her life like in total fear.
Yeah, I don't blame her because, I mean,
what happened to her sounds right. Really bad.
And like the term stalker, like he's called the Bowery Stalker. And then I think they did mention because Butch, they were like, hey, Butch, have you ever seen the guy before? And he's like, I don't know, maybe he had come into the diner. Which is weird because then he can't recognize him. So I'm not sure if they were trying to imply that it was possible he was stalking Annie. I actually forget if they even bring that up.
No, they do definitely talk about him stalking. Because it sounds like Butch says he was in the restaurant, but I never saw his face.
Yeah, something like that. So it's like, yeah, I would be scared too because clearly this guy, like,
knows stuff out. About you.
Right. So, like, and the fact that he didn't get caught means that he could be playing the long game, you know? So I would probably, that's what I would be saying to the disability office too. They'd be like, yeah, do you have a stalker? I do, so.
Munch finally gets her to do the lineup, and when she looks at the lineup of people, she has a very emotional reaction and falls into Munch, but she isn't there, and she's super relieved to see that. Sarah Kimmel is played by Anna Belknap, who, like Eddie Cahill from our previous episode, was a main character on CSI New York.
Oh.
Which I don't watch. But I thought that was pretty funny that we have two, like, main characters from CSI New York back to back. So, dun-dun, Funch walks Sarah back to her apartment, and once she's inside, they, I'm not going to say loudly, but not, like, quietly either, start discussing what to do next. And because I know what apartments in New York City are like, I was like, is she just, like, standing in her living room listening to them be like, oh, so what are we going to do next, man?
I thought that, too. Actually, when I had the fucking incense debacle, I heard people outside being like, do you smell that? I smell that. What do you think that's coming from? Like, right outside my apartment. And I was like,
They're not that quiet. So I was like, she can definitely hear them. So Finn thinks they should go to the tattoo parlor and talk to Elmo. Dun dun. At Elmo's, I assume they're talking to Elmo, and they're looking at a drawing of the tattoo. And he tells the detective that it's not his artwork. A guy brought it in last summer, but let him keep the sketch as a bonus. And I'm like, it's not that good of a sketch.
They're stupid.
It's like one of those tattoos, and you've all seen something like that, where it's like a claw scratch on your arm, but in the scratch there's
like a yellow
picture of a cat,
panther, yeah, or yeah. Something.
He let him keep the sketch as a bonus, and then they're like, well, how popular has it been? And he's like, well, I can count on one hand how many I've done.
Right? Like, so what is, like, this?
Which is it, Elmo? So they ask him if he keeps names and addresses, and he's like, no, but he luckily is one of our few witnesses who has a really good memory, and he remembers basically every person who wanted this tattoo. One was a guy who walked his cat on a leash, there was a female wrestler, a guy who smelled like rotten fish, so clearly Taggart, and then the guy who originally brought it in. This guy was a big fellow with a beard. He told them that Bobcat was a platoon name in the service. So they ask if they can take the sketch, and the tattoo artist is like, sure, no one likes it anyway.
That's what I mean. I'm like, what is
this? It's so funny.
It's almost like they forgot, like, the writer stopped, like, before they finished the scene. And he's like, oh, it's a great piece of artwork that literally no one but fucking weirdos want.
So we're at the Forensic Investigations Division, and this is the first time I've realized it's April because they, you know, showed, like, the card. So we basically, I think last episode might have been March. That is the only March episode we got.
Yeah, it was, like, the last day of the investigation was March 1st. Because I remember being like, we are finally in March.
They were like, we all took March off.
Yeah.
We all hate each other now.
They probably IRL did realize they were like, fuck, we did like every single day in
10
February.
Cases in February.
And they're probably like, realistically, this wouldn't happen.
I don't know why they couldn't make some of that in March.
Yeah, they could have literally just made, like, Countdown could have been in March, honestly, because then or even Folly could have been just all March. It could have been March.
There was, like, no snow on the ground, so I don't know why it couldn't be March.
Yeah, and then sometimes there's snow in March. Like, you know, it's just weird. Yeah. They could just, you know, it's just little things that we would tweak if we were in the writer's room.
No, 100%. I was like, okay. Fuck March, I guess. A lab tech who we've definitely seen before, but
yeah,
he doesn't get
like a
name.
A while ago.
Yeah. Says he got some prints off this sketch, which I thought was a pretty lucky break.
I know. Like,
okay, I guess I'll believe that.
Old prints?
So they got these prints. One set belongs to the tattoo artist, and the other set belongs to a Daryl R. Kern, who was discharged from the Army in 1999. Which I was like, oh, wow, forever ago. And then I'm like, oh, no, that's like just like 2 years ago.
It feels like
this episode.
Right. Like, it feels like so much fucking longer.
Okay. I'm laughing for an inappropriate reason, and you can cut this. I'm laughing because it's a tactical team scene. And after these notes, I realized there are fucking four tactical scenes where they like roll up on places.
They're all a little the same. Like every
They're all exactly the same almost, except for like location.
Like, and then the locations, again, they're different locations, but they're similar enough where, except for like maybe the last one where I was like, wait, is it happening again? Did I skip back? And it's like the same music, like,
but I swear this is why my notes are so short, because that's like four different scenes that should have been like an additional page of notes.
Right.
But I have like three lines. I'm like, they pull up. He's not there.
Yeah.
So Funch and a tactical team roll up to Kern's apartment. When no one answers the door, they break down the door. Some great writing there.
I do that to myself all the time. I know. And it's like, you have to give yourself levity.
So the apartment is filled with weapons, and Munch finds an Easy Pass bill. And I wrote, holy shit, though, they had those in 01.
I did the same thing. I'm like, is that how old Easy? Because I swear to God, in my mind, it didn't exist until I was driving a car.
I thought like 2015. I don't know. Well, clearly I'm wrong. Yeah, not 2015. 2005.
I
get my 10s and my O's so confused. And people are like, that happened in 03. And I'm like, okay, fuck you. It was 2013. Sorry.
No, I'm not comfortable with the fact that, like, it's 2025, but it's not.
No, it's absolutely not.
It's not.
So from this Easy Pass bill, they're able to discern that Kern does a lot of driving and to one place in particular. So dun-dun, back at the station, Munch explains to Cragen, Benson, and Stabler that Kern is constantly traveling the same route since last June, always to the same location in upstate New York, Walden Falls. They also have been able to figure out that 7 women have gone missing within a day of each of these trips, and Stabler remarks that there is a lot of unspoiled wilderness up there. Cragen tells Munch and Finn to pack their bags, they're going on a road trip. So, dun-dun, Funch pull into North Bumfuck, New York, arguing like an old married couple about Finn's driving. I tune all that shit out.
I did too. There was some banter. I know. Whenever they were like, it's funny, I should have been more tuned in when they were like on the road. But every time they entered, like even when they interviewed the other police, I'm like, I'm a cop. No, I'm a cop.
So they enter the local precinct and they discuss that Cragen has briefed the locals. So it's not going to be like that time Benson and Stabler went to talk to those two other cops. And they were like, do you hear that? It sounds like the wind.
All uppity up in a diner.
When there's like something really serious happening. So inside, the police chief welcomes them to Walden Falls and he can't pronounce Odafin. So Finn's like, it's just call me Finn. This hick tells them he knows everyone in town, so if their guy is here, he is keeping a low profile. He introduces them to Officer Cheryl Baxter, who is going to show them around, and they head over to the local store that they know Kern likes to frequent.
Cheryl's kind of annoying. She just keeps going like, hey, come on now. Hey now, come on now. Hey, come on now.
I'm going to pause here. Cheryl Baxter is played by Charlotte Meyer, and she's been in a bunch of stuff. But randomly, probably what I know her best for. Do you remember when they remade the Pink Panther movies in 2006 with Steve Martin?
I did, but I did not see them. I heard they were.
So they're terrible. But do you remember the trailers?
Yeah.
Do you remember the most obnoxious scene is Steve Martin trying to pronounce hamburger? And he's going,
Hamburger.
She's the dialect coach in that scene.
Oh.
I would like to buy a hamburger.
I would like to buy a hamburger.
I would like to buy a hamburger.
I was like going through her IMDb and I'm like, dialect coach, Pink Panther. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God.
That might actually be like, that's
pretty... her like most, that's like her, what she would be most well known for.
Yeah, no. And that's kind of a decent thing to like have as a reference, because I think a lot of people know that and like they're like, yeah, of course I know that part in the trailer.
It's so stupid. So they show his photo to the store owner, who says that he's pretty sure Kern has a cabin around here, but he doesn't know where. But because he knows Kern likes to hunt, he believes it's out on one of like these like lonely country roads that doesn't, they don't even have names, they just have like numbers, I guess.
Ew.
But disturbingly, the last time he saw Kern, he saw he had a lady friend with him, so uh-oh. Finn asks him about his hunting comment, and the shop owner is like, oh, well, actually, he didn't say he liked to hunt, but I only assume that because he spends a lot of time at Jordy's Guns and Ammo. So next stop is Jordy's Guns and Ammo, and there the owner or whoever looks at the photo and identifies him as Arnold Coakley. They ask him about the cabin, and he thinks it might be north of town. Wherever it is, he knows it must be well-stocked with guns, ammo, and provisions. So Munch asks if they can look at his paperwork. Well, Munch asks if he would mind if they looked at his paperwork, and the guy goes, I mind. And Officer Cheryl's like,
come on, Jordy.
Tells him to cut the shit. And he hands over the paperwork, but he's a wicked dick about it.
Makes a comment about Russia. He's like,
he's one of those, I thought this was America.
Upstate New York is so different than New York City. It's almost like jarring.
So back at the station, Officer Cheryl is looking through their database to see if there is land registered to Kern or Coakley. Finn is impressed. Their tech is way better than what they have back in New York City.
Which makes no sense, again, based on what I just said.
I know. I'm like, really? Okay. Munch enters, and he just got off the phone with Benson, who learned from missing persons that Arnold Coakley and his wife Amanda went missing from Tribeca 5 months ago. Because Coakley's ID was used in a fraudulent firearms purchase, ATF is now getting involved. And Finn's like, okay, well, considering how highly armed we know this guy is, I don't really think that that is a bad thing. But we know Munch is just, like, super sensitive about this case. So Officer Cheryl pipes in that there is no Kern or Coakley in the system, and then Munch gives her a list of people who've gone missing around the same time of his other trips that she can kind of check through their fancy system that's better than what they have in the big city.
She's like, I'll have it printed out in 2 minutes, and I'm like, it's just,
really?
Not that easy, ever.
Dun dun, we head to the Blackbird Motor Lodge, and we get to see Munch and Finn in their jammies. I would like to give a shout out to wardrobe, because these jammies are exactly what you would picture for Munch and Finn jammies.
Yeah, they are. Munch is in like a satin pajama suit.
All black.
All black. Yep.
Finn is salty that the department wouldn't shell out for 2 rooms. And Munch is like, get used to it, as he trims his nose hairs in the bathroom. I was like, come on, man. You can't not do that for 1 day. Poor Finn.
Is that how fast they grow?
So Finn finally recounts the accommodations and narcotics. Basically, when he was undercover, he'd be put up in really nice apartments. But we also learn that he currently lives in a small apartment in Brooklyn. So Munch sits down next to Finn to file his nails. And again, I'm just like, do you do this like every night?
His nighttime routine is all gross.
I know, mine's like cute and just, you know, putting on like moisturizer and like brushing my teeth. And he's like trimming nose hairs and like filing. I'm like, why don't you start clipping your toenails, John?
I was like excavating.
He asks Finn why he left narcotics, and we learn that Finn's partner took a bullet for him. Finn asks Munch why he left homicide, and Munch tells him that when his last marriage ended, he returned to New York from Baltimore, and the only department with any openings was SVU. He's like, well, I figure I've seen enough dead bodies, and the change would do me good. But little did he know that it would be the live victims that would really rip your heart out.
I know, that really sucks. Like, that's the worst, when you take a new job and you're like, maybe this will be a little better than the last one. It's like way worse and stressful.
Way more traumatizing.
Way more traumatizing.
So Munch's cell phone rings, and it's Elliot. They found blueprints for a bomb shelter drawn by a contractor in Walden Falls. So Munch calls Officer Cheryl and asks that this owner of McCartney Lumber and Cement meet them at the station.
And if you're wondering where Elliot and Olivia are this entire time, they do not tell us. Presumably, they're just, like, doing random work for this case in the city. But I have a theory that they're not even, like, I think they come back, but I think they're just, like, upstate in Montauk.
They are in two scenes, I think.
Yeah, that's it. That's two scenes.
Like, we've seen half of their scenes this episode.
It's crazy. I'm like, what is going on? They just are blatantly not in this episode. I'm having mad deja vu right now.
Ooh.
Yeah, like, really bad. It's crazy. I know. I'm like, what does that mean?
Chris and Mariska must have loved this episode, though, because they got paid but got to just, like, not come to work. Dun, dun. So we cut to the police station where the captain from earlier, not Cragen, the captain of this bumfuck town.
Yeah.
And a fed are facing off with their faces, like, literally inches from each other. And Munch comes in I almost said de-escalate, but that's not what I wrote. Munch comes in and starts escalating the situation. Mm. And we learn that this fed is Gus Stone from AFT. He looked familiar, and I think it's just because he did one episode of Sex and the City.
Oh, sometimes that's all you need.
Oh, yeah. I have seen Sex and the City so often that if they have been in one episode, I probably recognize them. I couldn't tell you what episode he was in, but I'm like, oh no, I can see him as, like, one of the boyfriends or people they date.
That's been, like, me with Oz in this show. I'm like, that person seems familiar. They're like, because he was in Oz. I'm like,
he was in Oz.
Everyone. Oz was the 90s or the early 2000s version of Orange is the New Black.
Oz is Orange is the New Black for boys.
Exactly.
Straight boys. Officer Cheryl and Mr. McCartney walk in, and Munch asks McCartney if he recognizes the blueprints. He's like, sure do. Guy came in last summer saying he needed a bunker for Armageddon and the race wars. He is like, not that I subscribe to that shit. I just, like, will take money from whoever.
I would never work on someone's property who said things like that. Like, that's just asking to get killed. I would just be worried they'd kill
me. I know. I'd be worried they'd kill me.
Right. Like, you build them this whole bunker and then they lock you in it.
Exactly. So they drew up the plans for an underground bunker fortified with 12-inch cement blocks. He built it about 10 miles up north, and he gives them the location. And he mentions that there was already a cabin built on the site. They round up the troops. It's going to be a combo of local police and AFT agents, and they head out. So that morning, we're here for raid number two, if you're keeping count. All these people are a-sneaking and a-snooking through the woods. They're just like, Claire, hopping out from behind rocks and trees. It's actually a little funny to watch.
Yeah, they're like, don't worry, he can't see us.
They sneak through the woods and up to the cabin, and they bust down the door and look around. No one's here. Ugh, the poor captain yells to them from outside, and he is standing by a bulkhead looking absolutely sick to his stomach. Finn and Munch enter the bunker, where they find Annie's body. It's bloody and naked on the floor, and Munch quietly murmurs, sorry, Annie. And they look around and take in all these instruments of torture hanging on the walls.
I will say, I think they could have been a little bit more eclectic with their selection because it was just kind of like chains repeated.
I didn't see anything where I was like, oh no, a weapon.
Right. They just, like, it would have been like, obviously it was like, oh no. When you kind of slowed it down, it was just like a lot of chains, I think.
Prop, I think, is wicked lazy in SVU. I have called them out multiple times.
And I will insult a home as soon as I see it. And we walk into a home, I'm like, oh, they couldn't have done a better job scouting for this location.
Like, they couldn't have found, like, a couple, like, axes and, like, rusty chainsaws and shit.
Annie's body, I'm not being like, oh, they could have, but they could have done a little bit of a better job on her body given how much damage we hear was done to it, because what we see of her, just her back, it was like scratches and stuff, and she's clearly dead and there's blood, yeah, like under her, so you know something, obviously she's dead, but oh my god. But then
so hours later they have uncovered 15 bodies buried in shallow graves, and three were children.
Yeah,
sad. So Gus Stone thinks that Kern left about an hour before they got there based on the tire tracks. I was like, you can really? You can tell it's that fresh?
I don't even know. Like, I know.
So Finn thinks someone tipped him off. And Munch is in the bunker talking to the coroner, who remarks that she goes, I could have lived my entire life without seeing something like this. And I'm like, you know what, honey, I sympathize, but that's kind of the risk you take when you become a coroner.
I was thinking that too, kind of like the same, again, it's like you sort of sign up for certain professions thinking, maybe I'll run into this.
I could picture like maybe someone else they work with, like a, I'm trying to think of someone who that would be appropriate from, like, I don't even know.
Not even like a
basically
doctor.
All these people should be kind of prepared. The coroner begins listing the injuries, including most horrifically. And you know what? If you're squeamish, jump ahead. It's not like the worst thing ever, but it's pretty bad. So no, if you don't want to hear what I'm
really
about to say.
Gross.
Like, yeah, go ahead. Skip. It's a bad visual.
It's gross.
All right. Time's up. I'm going to say it.
Yeah, here it comes. It's disgusting. Here we go.
Mutilation pattern suggests she was penetrated with foreign objects, possibly a knife. All right, moving on.
Took my headphones out. Like, just gross. It gross. Was gross. It was gross.
All before he blew her face off with a .44. Mercifully, Officer Cheryl arrives to tell him there's something in the cabin he should see. So inside the cabin, the captain reads some gobbledygook from a notebook that they're calling like an operations manual. And it talks about like missions and worms and apples and being compromised. And basically from this like worm talk, they deduce that he had an accomplice. Munch remarks that serial killers do tend to be loners, but when they pair off, the stronger personality tends to dominate. And this is why they have thought it was a single perp the whole time, because the other person is living in his shadow.
You just didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. Gus Stone, who doesn't want to be left out, chimes in that the manual says they're going to rendezvous. And then based on the worm and the apple comment, they figure he is headed back to the Big Apple, NYC.
So annoying when people get way too into like military terms. It's like very annoying.
When he was just a little bitch ass cook.
I know. I hate that's the only type of people who talk like that, or like cop impersonators are the only ones who like use cop jargon.
So dun dun, back we go to SVU, and Finn and Munch update Cragen. I was trying to be clever. I was like, update Cragen with a CR. And I'm like, Brittany, what the fuck is a CR? It's a Cragen rundown. And explain that he writes in pseudo-military code. He calls the accomplice the worm and himself the eagle. So you know how he feels about himself.
Annoying.
He sounds insufferable. So his operations manual lists target and ops from the last 3 years. And they deduce that the targets are the victims and the ops is their torture and murder.
I didn't get that, by the way. Just terminology-wise, because, like, the ops in my in jargon slang, it's like, the opposition, you know?
Oh, I guess operations?
Oh, operations. Okay.
So he has killed entire families for their credit cards and ID. He killed a plumber for this cabin. And since this operation was compromised, they believe he returned to NYC to grab this accomplice and then hit the road. So they think this accomplice might be a military buddy since they communicate using this code. So Cragen sends Funch to talk to the captain or something of Fort Dix, where Kern was stationed. I feel like someone should have been doing this already.
Yeah.
And that's just occurring to me, but I'm like, all right, so they like...
How long have they had this? Yeah, because Bobcat, right? They should have looked into it.
No, when they lifted his prints.
Oh, yeah.
They knew he was a military person. So Benson and Stabler could have been doing that instead of the nothing they've been up to all episode.
This happened last episode. They were like, oh, I think it was the two semen thing. We're like, how come it took us so long to get to this?
So they head over. I wrote there because I think I just didn't want to fuck up too much military jargon. But I think they went to Fort Dix itself.
I think they did. I think they did.
And they're talking to a captain and the captain's friend. They're talking to two important guys. So this guy tells them that this is an elite group and they do special stuff. Kern was trained as a weapons specialist, but he's so dumb they had to have him be a cook.
That's crazy. Like, how do you train as something and then they're like, yeah, you're going to be a cook now?
The military guy says that they saw Kern was sadistic and this eventually led to his discharge. Funch are like, oh, can you be more specific? And we're just treated to a horrible story about how, like, I guess their squad had like a local squirrel who they thought was cute, and Kern did something bad to the squirrel. He was later diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder and they kicked him out of the army. Finn asks if he had any friends and they say he pretty much stayed to himself except for a guy who made dry goods deliveries to the mess hall, and they seem to be on this same kind of freaky wavelength. So they ask if they can meet this guy, and the captain army guy says he doesn't deliver here anymore, but they will give them the name of the company.
I like how he was like, yeah, they both seem like they're on the same wavelength, meaning they both seemed fucking creepy.
So, dun dun, we head over to Magoo's vending company. And the boss of Magoo says they are looking for Marvin Posey, one of his best guys. He's one of his best guys.
He was so annoying. He kept, I guess it's like what a normal person would be doing, but it felt like he was fighting them. It was so frustrating.
He's like, but he's one of my best guys.
Yeah, did he do something wrong? It's like, yeah, the police are here to talk to him, so.
Again, I get so fucked up on timelines because they're saying he's been with the company for 8 years. And in my head, this whole ordeal has been spanning for like a decade, but it's really just been like a year.
Yeah.
Which, of fuck shit.
Which is, it is still strange though. It's like, I guess people can just crack, but he did all this fuck shit. Like, it's only been a year. You know what I mean? Usually there's like a slow escalation, but
yeah.
I guess they kind of get into that at the end, but.
So they ask where they can find Marvin, and the boss is like, oh, well, he isn't working today. He's doing National Guard maneuvers. And Munch is like, oh, he's a weekend warrior. And Finn's like, yeah, and today's Thursday. But this bozo's like, well, yeah, sometimes these maneuvers like aren't on the weekends. They can go for like several days.
Even if this were true, I'd be so like sus. Yo, I have secret missions. Okay.
So this boss is all like, well, he's doing his patriotic duty, so I really don't bother him. And Munch is like, okay, how often does he go in these like cute little maneuvers? And the guy's like, I don't know, like once a month, sometimes every other month. I don't know. Sometimes there isn't one. Sometimes there are a few days. And they're like, okay.
This scene takes so long. Sorry, not you telling it. This scene in real time, I remember watching it with my mouth open being like it was like a tennis match. I was like, are we still doing this?
Well, at some point for no reason, and I didn't even take note of it because it's stupid. He's like, hey, what are you doing? Like, starts like yelling at some of his employees.
Yeah, he's like, oh, excuse me, like, can I head out? And they're like, yeah. Oh, because they needed the address. And he kept being like, why do I need to give you the address? And it's like, why are you also a fucking criminal?
So finally they get Marvin's address, and dun dun, we have our third tactical raid.
Oh my God. It's
not calling them the right words, tactical. We have our third raid.
No, you're right, though. And it's weird. Until you pointed it out, I really didn't notice how funny this was. They kept being like, all right.
All right, we're going to get him this time. It's a raid. This time we're at the home of Marvin Posey. So they bang on the door and tell Marvin to come out. But instead of Marvin, we get this sweet old lady who answers the door, and she doesn't even look scared of like all these guns. She's just like, hey, Marvin's not home. What's up?
She's so sweet. She literally leads with her smile. Like they open the door and you just see her mouth first come out like, hello. She's British, of course.
Oh, hey, he's not home. He left this morning. I'm sorry.
I could be mistaken, but I believe she does, of course, like the obligatory looks around at all the men pointing guns at her and goes, are you friends of Marvin?
No, she does. She's like, are you his friends? And Munch is like, put down your guns. Put down your fucking guns. This looks bad. So inside, this old lady makes Funch a spot of tea as she explains that Marvin was called away.
So cute. She offers them. She's like, would you like some milk with your cheese? And I was like,
she is so sweet. This is his Aunt Mary, who she is all of our Aunt Marys. And not the aunt this piece of shit deserves, because seems wicked nice and he fucking sucks. She tells them that Marvin's mother died when he was a child. Also, she is saying this like very placidly. She's like, yeah, his mom died when he was a kid, beaten to death by his father. You know, how terrible.
Hilariously, she's pouring their tea and they're like, yeah, so tell us about Marvin. And she's like, oh, they asked if she was his mother. And she's like, no, yes. I'm his Aunt Mary. And she's pouring the tea. She goes, his mother was beaten to death by his father with an iron. She didn't like the way he did his shirts. She's like pouring their tea.
And they're like, oh, okay. And she's like, yeah, this is really hard on a child. So I just tried to raise him with all the love I could. She's like very upbeat.
She's so upbeat. I want to be like, was this your sister or your brother? Because either way, you're handling it so well.
So Munch asks if Aunt Mary knows where Marvin is. And she's like, well, it's a secret. So he's with the Green Berets. And in fact, there's his scrapbook right there.
Oh, I bet she sits there and looks at it while he's gone.
Finn opens it and begins flipping through the book as Munch asks how they can get in touch with Marvin. And Mary tells him that he usually has his cell phone on him. Finn sees something in the book and gets Munch's attention, and he shows him a page as Aunt Mary's like, oh, that's Marvin with his friend Daryl. And there next to Daryl Kern is our good Samaritan, Martin Potter, from the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, the guy we've been shitting on. So now you know why. Fucking dum-dum.
And if you watch the episode, the way he comes from around the vehicle, if you know, is a little suspicious.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like he comes out from the passenger side.
And he says, like, as I said earlier, he says, get off him. And so at first you're thinking he's saying it to Daryl as he's, like, wrestling away Butch the Good Samaritan. But he's saying it to Butch about Daryl. And then Daryl literally just shoves Marvin into Butch, thusly abandoning him. And then Marvin's yelling, get back here, because he wants to get – and Munch says that. He's like, he wasn't trying to stop the car. He was trying to get in. They never moved the bodies. They just moved the headstones.
They never moved the bodies. So dun-dun, outside the house, Munch is absolutely furious that they had Marvin, as Finn – as you said, Finn remarks that he wasn't trying to stop the 4x4. He was trying to get in it. So Finn receives a call. They found the 4x4, and a clean-shaven man has abducted a mother and a child in their car, and they're headed north towards Canada.
Ugh.
So, dun-dun, the bullpen is a-buzzing as the reunited squad talks about the carjacking and the likelihood that Kern has fled to Canada. Olivia, who has had almost not a thing to do this episode, runs over with the info from Marvin's phone.
She has fresh highlights. She
looks
highlights.
Beautiful.
She got highlights on the way back from their trip up to the North Fork.
Marvin received a call from Annie's cell phone the day after her abduction, and they have been exchanging calls ever since, and they assume that the two are going to try to meet up en route, and Cragen calls for a track on both phones. Why didn't you do that already?
I was wondering. I'm like, you know, it's so weird that Annie had a cell phone this whole time. Now, granted, then again, people weren't as smart about early cell phone usage, but like, why weren't
that's
they
what
tracking?
I had to tell myself, but that still seems like a wicked miss.
Yeah, like, why haven't they just been tracking it periodically? Like, why haven't they
could have tracked it to Walden Falls, like, maybe like a full day earlier than they did before.
Yeah, exactly. This is a frustrating detail.
So this is a wicked quick scene, but Funch go and talk to the tracking people at the internet who show them where Kern and Posey's paths have crossed, and it is near the Canadian border. So Munch calls the state police and tells Finn they're going to head north. So dun-dun, I wrote north, dun-dun.
Yeah.
So ATF and state police meet Funch where they have found, I think they found Kern and Posey's cars outside of a house. But somehow someone, like, spotted the cars, I guess. Oh, and I should say that Gus Stone is back here. And woohoo. So raid number 4 commences. And it's actually kind of funny at this point because they just do the same fucking thing as they've done the last, like, 3 times.
Yeah.
As the feds bust into the farmhouse, Finn and Munch go to clear a shed on the property. Munch busts down the door to find the hanging body of Marvin Posey, and it is a ghastly sight. There's blood pooling on the floor.
How many phones are strapped to him?
So he is hanging from his wrists as blood pools below him, and he has 2 cell phones taped to his shirt, and what was the point of that? So that they could, like, tracking on cell phones was not that good, so it's not like he was, like, leading them right to Marvin's body.
Well, I think that was what they were trying to do. I think it was supposed to be like, oh, we have a hit on both cell phones. Like, we're going to get them both. And he strapped them to Marvin, so, like, he's now untraceable again.
But, like, he could have just left the 2 phones in the house. Like, it was almost like, oh, it was like almost like they planned to have, like, a beep thing, and it's like, beep, 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 we're getting close to the 2 phones. Beep, beep, beep. Oh, they're right here. Like,
I think he just wanted not that good. I think it was like, I think that part was just for dramatic effect. They were like, yes. you want the phones are strapped to dumbass Marvin.
Marvin. And I think his throat has been a slit.
I thought it may be disemboweled.
So this is just too much for Munch, who goes outside to start kicking trash cans and screaming, son of a bitch. And I know what you're thinking. Oh my God, will they ever catch him? Finn tries to calm him down and says he still needs the mother and kid. So they're
I kind of don't know why, though. Currently. They're like, yeah. He needs them. And I'm like, why?
I'm like, why?
For what? It's actually less distracting not having hostages.
And then Finn steps away to answer a call, and Gus Stone tells them that they have an APB on the farmer's pickup. They've warned Canada. And Stone assures Munch that he's running out of steam. And Munch is like, but how many people must die before he does? And Finn comes back. He's like, oh, no, they got him.
Yeah, because we keep, like, we're not even including every time they open their mouths. They're like, yeah, so we just killed someone else. Like,
oh, yeah, they didn't even mention, like, two people are dead in this farmhouse. Finn returns with good news that Kern has been arrested for shoplifting at an auto parts store in Canada. Mother and child are fine. And the police are holding Kern per Cragen's request. I'm like, per Cragen's request, you should just fucking hold that guy.
I know, why?
So we're now in Ontario, Canada. So Munch and Finn arrive to find Cabot waiting for them. And she tells them that Kern is in a holding cell. And she is here serving the extra. They're actually like, why are you here? And she's like, I'm here to fucking get this guy back to good old NYC. Obviously, Kern is fighting extradition. And Cabot is going to have to go through the courts. And they're like, all right, well, let's go talk to these hostages. Cut to finding Miss Michelson in I'm going to guess Canada's nice interrogation room. And she looks fucking awful. I was like, does she always look this bad or just after being kidnapped?
Yeah, I guess because this is not me being like, I guess because she's witness. But they really were like, let's just make her look like the life has been fucking sucked out of her. And I'm like, I guess it's because she witnessed like 4 murders or whatever.
Well, she's like dirty as hell and she needs to brush her. I'm like, you know what? They couldn't have given her a hairbrush.
They also do not fill us in on like what specifically happened to her that I heard. I mean, I might have tuned out if they did. But like, as far as we know, I think it's probably implied that he was sexually assaulted her or something. But like, they're not like, this is what he did to her.
I don't think they say. So I'm just going to choose to assume they didn't, only because we've heard so much horror. So she asks how long this is going to take because she wants to be in the hospital room when her daughter wakes up. I love when they kind of just ignore them and start asking questions.
They're, I know,
like, how long? And they're like, so anyway.
Well, Brittany, she's not rich enough to sequester, so.
No, she has to. Well, she's dirty and poor, so she has to stand here and answer their questions.
He jacked their Ford Taurus, so they're like, ew, you have to be traumatized all over again.
So Munch asks her about he's like, I need to know about the time you spent with Kern before they crossed the border. So she tells them that Kern threatened her with a knife and told her to move over. And he threatened to kill her daughter, who was in the back seat. When they got to the farmhouse, he put a knife to her back and made her go knock at the front door.
Ugh.
And an old woman answered. He asked her for directions. And then when she turned to go back into the house, he slit her throat. The husband came running, but before he could say anything, Kern cut his throat too. And then later, Posey came. Kern told Posey he had something to show him in the barn. And then she heard like horrific screaming, and Kern came out covered in blood. So he quickly changed his clothes and then made them all get into the farmer's pickup truck. And he said they were going to Canada. And he was like, and I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you and your kid like I've killed everybody else. Oh, he's so annoying.
He's just such a dick.
And he also said that the police were so stupid that they'd never find him.
Yeah.
And Munch goes. So outside the room, Finn remarks that Posey was alive when Kern gutted him. I'm like, why do we care about Posey? I'm sorry. Like, of all the people in this episode I give a flying fuck about, it's not Marvin Posey.
I guess, like, you can gut somebody post-mortem. Like, so I know that literally you can do that. But just, I don't know. Logically, most people are alive when you gut them. It's like when...
That's how you kill them.
It's right.
Like, she was alive when she was shot. Yeah, like, that's how you... Okay.
Never forget when Snooki was like, yeah, I don't like to eat lobsters because they're alive when you kill them.
That's why I don't eat freaking lobster or anything like that. Because they're alive when you kill it.
I knew what she meant, but she didn't say what she meant.
So Cabot tells Munch that they are cross-referencing DNA with the info from Kern's little pissy diary. But a confession would really strengthen the case. They really even need a confession. I think they're just like, they need a scene with Kern because we've heard so much about him.
Exactly.
Honestly, he might be like the sickest fuck we've had so far in this show. He just is like a berserker. He just kills and maims every person he meets for fun.
Genuinely zero impulse control, like just kills people.
So dun dun, we're now in Canada's mean interrogation room, and Munch enters. I guess I didn't really like this scene because of the way I described it. He comes in like hot making fun of Kern for getting caught shoplifting, but immediately kind of like shifts to flattery He's like, oh, got caught shoplifting, idiot. And then he's like, oh, but like, yeah, I could never catch you. You're just so like big and tough. We found your manual. It's like really impressive. We're going to teach it at the academy. It's almost like a guy trying to hit on you by like giving you a compliment, but then like negging you. And Kern is just like staring straight ahead through this whole thing. Just like,
You can really get, this is for Oz fans. You really get a look at his James Robeson here, because in Oz, he didn't have a beard. So like, I wonder if they like, for the pictures of him with a beard, they like glued one on.
I mean, that even could have been another actor with how fast that scene. I doubt it is.
It didn't
is,
look like him. Probably,
it looks more like Thatcher. That's not his name. The stinky fish guy.
Yeah, Fred Taggart, who basically, yes. Again, like, I'm like, what is this, some kind of like female abusive bald guy tattoo pact? He's like, I want that tattoo. I feel connected to it.
Oh, man. I don't think I even mentioned what he did. I just mentioned he was on parole for like hitting somebody.
Oh, I think I made like a light comment that he beat the shit out of his girlfriend.
I'm glad you did, because I didn't write down what he did. Munch is just like doing his little bit, and then he's like, well, the cops are going to want to learn from your mistakes. And finally, Kern is like, what mistake? So Munch is like, Sarah Kimmel. And Kern is like, who the what now? And
yeah, he's trying to play it cool. He knows who that is.
Finally, he says that was Marvin's fault. And apparently, like, it sounds like Daryl like left her unchained and untied up because Marvin was supposed to be there like any minute. But Marvin was like half an hour late and called him like, oh, shit, I lost the girl.
They didn't like go into the specifics of her confinement. But yeah, like it was kind of almost it's talk about slapstick.
He's like, I should have eliminated him then.
You're such a nerd. Ooh, eliminated. Me.
I'm tall, but I use stupid words.
Kind of hot, but
he's super hot, unfortunately.
Kind of pretty.
Listen,
pretty
he's based on a real person, but not a real person.
He's probably very nice in real life.
Yes.
So Munch asks why he like hadn't already eliminated Marvin, and Kern's like, oh, well, he served a purpose. And apparently he hooked him up with Ernie, the guy who owned the cabin. So Kern describes getting invited up to the cabin for a hunting trip and then slitting Ernie's throat. And Munch is like, all right, well, what's the deal with the bunker? And Kern is so pretentious, he's like, well, I don't really like eating where I work. So Munch asks how many victims there are, and he mentions that they've found 18, and Kern's like, there are more. So Munch again asks how many, and Kern's like, a few. And then Munch tries a stabler and kicks a chair. He does not do police brutality as good as Stabler. I was like,
no, he's
come
not
on,
scary
John.
Enough. Because you know you can't, I'm sorry, I love you, you can't kick ass though.
At this point, Kern just starts trolling him. He's like, you know what? You should be used to this. I have been one step ahead of you since you stormed the warehouse. And then he disturbingly is like, I have thought about you every time I took a new girl. And every time they screamed, I had a little laugh. Like, I'm having a little laugh at you right now. And Munch is like, well, I'm going to have a big laugh when you finally get fried at your execution. And Kern's like, guess what, bitch? Canada doesn't extradite for capital offenses, motherfucker. So I love this. Munch like just like stomps out of the room and up to Cabot, like Cabot's his mommy, and is like, he said that we can't extradite him to the US for a capital offense. And she's like, yeah, he can say that, like, I'm gonna have my day in court. Pipe down, John. She's so sexy this episode. Listen, I have no intention of going home empty-handed, so you've done your job. Let me do mine. Dun, dun. Ontario Superior Court of Justice. And it's Friday the 13th.
Oh!
So some fucking nerd is saying to the judge that the Supreme Court was unequivocal in its decision to not extradite prisoners charged with capital offenses. And the Canadian judge is like, all right, fair. Are you afraid that this is going to make Canada a haven for dangerous criminals looking to skip out on the death penalty? And this smug little asshole is like, well, I'd prefer not to speculate on hypothetical situations which may or may not result from the ruling. And I'm like, what
Sir,
do you mean a hypothetical situation? It's happening right the fuck now.
Why he was going to Canada on the chance that he got caught.
Cabot smoothly says she respects the High Court's ruling, but it doesn't apply to this case in which New York is seeking extradition. And the judge is like, didn't he do a bunch of bad shit? Isn't that, like, why you want him? And she's like, yeah, he did do a bunch of bad shit, but we just want him for possession of stolen property.
We're not going to kill him.
She's like, yeah, we just want him for this stolen property shit.
Are they allowed to lie like that? Like, Or do they have to then not kill him? I actually missed if there was like any caveat.
No, she just basically had to redo her paperwork.
Okay.
And it's she was like, listen, at this point, we are not seeking. Because got that's it. Why then the little creep is like,
oh, they're just going to do it when we turn our back.
He's like, oh, my God, this is a blatant attempt to circumvent the law. And
so are you.
Cabot's like, okay, well, because the stolen property is valued over $5,000, it applies under this extradition law. And so the little creep is like, oh, my God, once they get him over the border, they're going to charge him with the serious stuff. And the judge looks him in the eye and's like, maybe, but this court prefers not to speculate on hypothetical situations which may or may not result from the ruling.
Ha ha.
Petition for the extradition is granted. And Kern starts looking around like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. You're going back home to America, where we might not always agree on the death penalty, but in this situation.
But this time we do. So at the border, Cabot, Finn, and Munch wait anxiously for Kern. And for a second, I thought it was going to be like, sorry, he escaped and killed 10 more people.
Same. I was like, ugh, they're going to make me so angry. I'm going to jump out this window.
But then, like Jacob Marley before him, he comes a clink clanking into the room surrounded by two U.S. Marshals. Finn reads him his rights. And then Munch, like, he actually kind of like comes up to Munch and leans in so that Munch can dunk on him.
I know. So weird. I was like, why are you guys about to kiss right now?
And Munch is like, welcome home, Daryl.
Loved it.
I would have done, because he was like, I was one step ahead of you. I would have leaned and been like, don't worry, Daryl. I'll be one step behind you the whole way home.
That would have been good.
It would have been. Well, we should have been writers for SVU.
See what I would have done? I would have gotten up there in his face. I would have been like, boop, boop.
Now, they should have just ended. They should have just executive producer Dick Wolf right here, because that was like a great ending. And then
I
it had
agree.
To go on for like another like 30 seconds. I was like, oh, never mind.
I feel bad, but I'm like, why did we need
to? I was like, awesome. And then I'm like, oh, fuck. We're still going. So Daryl is led away and Munch is like, thank you to Cabot because he was kind of a dick to her earlier. And believe it or not, dun, because we got one more scene.
Yeah, at first I was like, ugh, but anyway.
So back in NYC, Munch knocks on the door of Sarah Kimmel. She cautiously opens the door and Munch is like, you can leave your lights on tonight. And then he leaves. I would have been like, excuse me.
What do you mean?
Get
him? Is he dead? Yeah. Like, is he dead? I'd be more comfortable if he were dead.
Hey, that was really cool and all, but like,
yeah, she sort of just smiles at him knowingly, and I'm like, I'm gonna need specifics. Is he dead?
He's like, yes. Executive producer Dick Wolf.
Wow, that was a really good episode.
That was a good episode. This is like one of those episodes that is like ripped from the headlines, and it's based on serial murderers Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. During the mid-80s, Lake and Ng murdered 11 to 25 victims at a remote cabin near Wileysville, California. In a reverse from this episode, Lake was the dominant personality, but was arrested first on unrelated charges and swallowed cyanide pills and died. Hopefully it was very painful 4 days, but died 4 days later. And then Ng escaped to Canada, and then... like how in this episode, it was like one quick scene. There was like a lengthy battle over extradition, but he did eventually come to the U.S. Where he sits on death row to this day. I like from a TV viewer, what they did here makes way more sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's more satisfying too. Like I remember reading about this case and like the real one and being really frustrated that Leonard Lake was able to kill himself, because then when you found out what he did, and it literally was like, I forgot how many people he killed, and I recently reread it, like not even for this, and then I went back and I'm like, holy shit, the list is like insane.
I've never heard their case covered on a true crime podcast, and I listen to a lot of them. If I did, I don't remember it, but I typically have a pretty good ear for remembering like stories, like, oh, I've heard this before.
Yeah, what they left out about Leonard Lake and Charles Ng was that they also videotaped some of their crimes. Again, we won't bore you with the details, but very disturbing. Very disturbing.
I know what I'm Googling tonight and giving myself nightmares.
The videos
I'm alone.
I mean, they don't show you a lot, but like, again, it's just really like disturbing. You're like, oh, wow, the last days of these people's lives would have been horrifying. Anyway. Well, I don't really have any other notes to say about this. Yeah, like you said, it was pretty good episode. Really no, we kind of noted all the notes. There was not really too many goofs.
Well, there wasn't a ton of order, which always makes it a little smoother.
Always makes it smoother. And there no conspiracy.
Four raids, which I have to say, raids are very easy to recap when I can say, I mean, they spend like a full minute like hiding under rocks and shit for nothing to happen. So that's pretty easy to gloss over.
Well, everybody, a quick outro. Please subscribe to the podcast on whichever streaming platform you use. That doesn't mean you have to listen to us every day. Just subscribe. Apparently, that's how our metrics go up.
I love when people are like, oh, I don't want to listen. I'm like, just subscribe then.
Just subscribe.
Mom.
If you want to leave us a nice review, you don't even have to write anything.
Well, next time, Paige will be telling you about season 2, episode 19, Parasites.
Sounds gross.
Twin murdered woman.
Oh, wait. A woman who is a twin is murdered?
Yes, twins are murdered. A twin is murdered and her twin shows up and is like, I've got evidence, I think.
Oh my gosh, I don't recall this one. I remember that other really awesome twin one that was a twist and a turn.
So I think we have 3 episodes left. We have,
I think so.
You're doing Parasites. I'm doing the one after that. And then I think the one after that's the finale.
Yeah, I think so. Because I remember originally before we switched it every 2 weeks or every other week. Sorry, I'm going to burp. I remember thinking, oh, it'd be cool to get this done before the new year. And now I'm like, gruh, that would have been crazy.
Would we have done that?
I don't know how we did this.
It's probably going to be February before we finish.
We did this like
season 2
every week. And I know my job at the time wasn't as demanding, but like we did do this weekly for a while, which is crazy. And we were new at it. I don't know how we did that.
Beginners.
All this energy. I know. I'm like, it's crazy. Well, anyway, thanks again for tuning in, everybody, as usual.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for the kind words. Thank you, Sydney. Thank you, Perth.
And hey, we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye, squad.